Hi! Hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm Kay Albert Little, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is born out of one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor I was working for asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? Well, I was stumped and began a journey looking into the ancient roots of my faith, into the roots of the Bible, how it was put together, what books got in and what books were left out and why that happened and how churches changed and grew over time and how my faith tradition fit into all of that. Well, it was in that journey that I encountered the ancient Catholic Church. It looms large in church history, and there it was. And it was then as I began reading about Catholic theology and history and beliefs from actual Catholic sources that I realized what I thought I knew about Catholics was based in large part on misinformation, and honestly, more often than not, on simple misunderstandings. Well, this podcast serves to fill in that same gap, the gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. Each week, I have a real Catholic conversation with a real Catholic thinker from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And this week, I have a fantastic conversation to bring you with my new friend, Terry Polakovic. She is a fantastic woman and the author of Women of Hope, Doctors of the Church from Our Sunday Visitor. This is a great conversation. What Terry does is this. She has spent a long time in ministry as a leader of other women in ministry and a really important voice in the church, has some accolades under her belt from some popes as well. I have nothing to shake a stick at. It's fantastic. And she's kind of surveyed the landscape of the church these days in the world and felt discouraged. And so she turned herself and turns our eyes to these women doctors of the church, these bright lights, these people, these saints who the church has said, hey, look, here are some people that you can count on, you can rely on as people who have lived the Christian Catholic life, and you can model your lives after them. You can count on these people. It's a fantastic book, and what a great conversation. Really, Terry takes us from a place of sometimes discouragement, I know I feel that some days for sure, and I explain that in this episode, to a place of hope through the eyes of these women doctors of the church. Guys, I can't underscore this enough. Please do not skip this episode. It's a fantastic one. You are going to love it. This conversation and all others are brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/cordialcatholic, where a $5 or more month donation gives you access to automatic free draws for book giveaways every single month, including this book, Women of Hope, from Terry Polakovic, will be one of our books to give away during this month when this is airing. And all kinds of other books are following in that footstep. So please do check out patreon.com/cordialcatholic to help support this show. Some ways of my saying thank you as well. One-time donations also can be done at paypal.me/cordialcatholic, and all that support, monthly or one-time, helps this show to keep going and keep growing and helps to underpin this work we're doing, which, guys, is incredible and bearing some real amazing fruit, much to my surprise sometimes, by the absolute grace of God. And now, without any further ado, here's my fantastic conversation with Terry Polakovic on the incredible women doctors of the church. Please do listen and enjoy. Hey guys, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Just a reminder, if you are listening to us on podcast, we're available on YouTube as well at youtube.com/thecordialcatholic to watch this show. And if you're watching on YouTube, check out the podcast on every imaginable podcast platform. It's The Cordial Catholic. Please do subscribe or follow us. You get all those latest updates and episodes, and you can follow us there. So you can listen and watch or do both. It's up to you. We're going to have a great conversation this week. I am joined by Terry Polakovic. She is the co-founder of Endow, Educating on the Nature and Dignity of Women, and served as president of the organization from 2003 to 2015. Before retiring, she worked in nonprofit leadership for more than 30 years, and in 2010, she received the here we go. Pro Ecclesia et Pontifice for the Church and the Pontiff Award from Pope Benedict XVI. Thank you. Wow. In 2011, she's recognized as an outstanding Catholic leader by the Catholic Leadership Institute, and she's an author of Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design, and our fantastic new book, I'm holding it here in my hand, you can't see it there, but I can see it, Women of Hope, Doctors of the Church, from our Sunday Visitor. Terry, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show, and hello.
Thank you, and hello, and I'm thrilled to be here. I'm really grateful you asked me.
I'm thrilled to meet you, and kudos, credit goes to our mutual friend, Steve Weidenkopf. He introduced me to you and said, you got to have her on your show. It's a fantastic new book. And Steve, as listeners to this show know, Steve's a guy that we count on this show. We rely on Steve. He's got good recommendations. He's got fantastic books. He knows his stuff. So when he says, hey, Keith, here's a guest for you, I listen to Steve and say, yes, sir, and I email you right away. So thanks to Steve for connecting us. It's a fantastic book on women doctors of the church. And I want to set it up for you this way, Terry, before we dig into it. I receive all kinds of emails from listeners, and it's always very gratifying. But I received one recently that was kind of a bit heartrending. And it was from a listener who'd listened to the show and done RCIA and become Catholic thanks to the show, which is always mind-blowing for me to receive those kind of people who God is leading to the show and using me in some small way to do this thing. But he said, look, I'm Catholic now, and the state of the church is reminding me of the stuff you read about sometimes in history textbooks. Like, you read about these popes and anti-popes, these terrible priests doing awful things, or the church kind of corrupting and then reforming. And he said, it feels kind of like I became Catholic and now I'm in this, you know, I'm entering the church in kind of a dark period of time, right? There's kind of liturgy wars, right? There's people who are denying the validity of Vatican II, or is it a real council? Is it not? Is the Pope a real Pope, or is he not? And there's these so many polemics happening in the church that drive people out of the church and turn people away from entering the church and scare these new converts. And There's scandals, and there's all kinds of stuff. I think in my own life, I mean, I became Catholic. I'm a convert. Listeners to this program know this. I was a convert when the Spotlight movie came out. So that was a big scandal breaking as I was becoming Catholic. And those scandals haven't lessened or really decreased or subsided. I think even in my own parish, we had a priest who was a fairly good friend and a fantastic pastor who got caught up in some pretty terrible sacramental abuses, and he was laicized, and you know, that deeply affected our parish community and our family and myself in a major way. And I think of all these things, and I think of that email from the listener who's become Catholic and is kind of like, what's going on here? And I get your book in the mail, and Terry, you take us and you turn our eyes away from all of that to these women doctors of the church. And I go, oh, yes. So I wonder, because this is part of the introduction to the book, you write about this, you touch on this in a small way at least. Why the women doctors of the church as an antidote to some of these things that just drag us down into the mud? Why?
Why? Well, first of all, I want to tell your friend that he is not the only person that gets discouraged, and neither are you and neither am I, and I'm a cradle Catholic. It has been a very discouraging time. In fact, our friend Steve Weidenkopf, I have a habit of writing him about every 6 months and saying, is this the worst? Is this the worst? Because he always writes me back and said, no, Terry, it's not as bad as it used to be. It's not as bad. So, yes, I have to say, it was in the summer of 2018 that this book came to fruition, to my mind anyway. And it was because I was so discouraged with the church. I was so discouraged with the filth in the church. That was the summer that we learned about Cardinal McCarrick, or now laicized Mr. McCarrick. The Pennsylvania reports came out. I remember I was walking down the street somewhere, and there was a big headline in some newspaper, you know, about some priest, and maybe it was McCarrick, I don't know, but it was like, it was just the fact that we were on the front page of the newspaper for the filth in the church. It just was like gut wrenching. So anyway, I had always had this desire when I was working for Endow. One of the things I did do with Endow, which I should say what that is, it's an organization called Endow, Educating on the Nature and Dignity of Women. And what we did in that apostolate is we took particularly the writings of John Paul II, but then we did expand it over the years. And during the time I was working there, we wrote books on Edith Stein and Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena. I just had this idea that I wanted to pull some of these women together. In fact, I think Edith Stein will definitely one day end up being a doctor of the church. So I always was, you know, we had groups of women who took our studies. They, ended up being a program of study groups where women got together and that type of thing. So I was always trying to put before them strong women in the church who had done, you know, amazing things, even though they weren't priests, they weren't anything like that. They were beautiful. They started hospitals and schools and, you know, I find that almost embarrassing that there are people that say, you know, the Catholic Church is no good because the women can't be priests. They can be everything, you know. So I always tried to keep that before the women who in our groups, is that just to keep a positive light on what they could do to help in their church and in their world and in their school and all that type of thing. So anyway, back to the writing of the book, I was feeling, you know, quite discouraged. So my friend reminded me that, you know, that I had always wanted to do that. Maybe I just needed to take my focus off the church, you know, just take the look away for a while, which ended up being a really excellent idea. And so I just started diving into these women. And I just found them remarkable. They were so remarkable. But the thing about it most of all, is that they lived in time similar to ours. I mean, they lived in, you know, separate centuries and, you know, certainly circumstances were different, all that type of thing. But the problems they encountered were much like our own. So I just found that very interesting of how they pushed through, how they dealt with it, how they dealt with what was going on in the church, because in their times there was church abuse in every single, you know, these were four women, four different time periods, there was church abuse always. So anyway, that's kind of the background of the book.
That's fantastic. And I think about something that, I mean, the turning away from the church to look at these women saints, these doctors of the church, I think is a fantastic idea. And what you then bring to us and share with us as well, that same idea. I think of my friend Matt Swaim, who on this show talked about the fact that for most of church history, Catholics wouldn't have even necessarily known who the Pope was at that time in some cases, right? Because they're living out their lives. And they wouldn't have known who the bishop was necessarily, or who their archbishop was, or who all these things. But they would have known, I mean, their parish priests, and they would have known saints, the saints of the church, right? Those are the people that they would have known, had their eyes on. We have access to mass media and to social media, and we know that when the Pope says anything, right, or when bishops, they can go on Twitter and say whatever they want to all the time, and they do, and all kinds of priests say all kinds of different things, and sometimes it doesn't sound very Catholic, the things that they're saying. But we got to recognize, I think, as you help us to do here, is that that isn't, wasn't always the case for Catholics. We didn't have to know all those things or follow those bishops on Twitter, but we would have known about the saints, right? So you bring us back to focus us on these heroes of the faith. Maybe I can put it this way. Not every bishop is going to be a saint, right? But the church shows us who are the saints and says, hey, focus on these people, these brilliant women, turn your eyes to them, and they will show you how to live a Christ-like life in spite of what's going on around you, right? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I have a friend who's a principal of a grade school called St. Rose of Lima, And on the first day of every school year, she gathers all the students and tells them the story of St. Rose of Lima. She, you know, wants them to know who was behind this school, why this school was named for her. And it's just a tradition that they have. And it's a lovely tradition that students really look forward to it, even though they hear it year after year. And they can, you know, they can answer all the questions she asks, but it's just a repetitive of, this is a woman that we look to. This is who we are. And it's beautiful, I think.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Keeping our eyes on those saints, right? So you, right. you chose four women doctors of the church here in your book. Can you tell us who they are? And I wonder if, as we begin to dig into this, is there something that, other than being doctors of the church, that and I guess you mentioned already too, that they're all kind of lived in these kind of dark times in a sense, things that may connect all these four women together in the beginning. So who are they and what kind of, what connects them together apart from being doctors of the church?
Okay. Well, I'll have to think about that as I go along. But the first woman that I wrote about was Teresa of Avila. And she, you know, people love Teresa of Avila, you know, like non-Catholics, they love Teresa of Avila. And they love her because she's so gutsy. She's so, I would imagine, kind of radical for her time. But she didn't start out that way. She was started out in a family. I can't remember if the parents had 11 or 13 children. Anyway, it's a very large family in Spain, in Avila. And her mother died when she was 13. And she, the mother, they were a very prim and proper family. They said prayers and, you know, over in the evening, they'd have readings about saints and that type of thing. They were really well formed. But one of the things the mother liked to do when the father wasn't around is read romance novels. And she would let her children read romance novels and that type of thing. So I think it really got into Teresa's head that, you know, some of these people did some pretty wild things, you know, that type of thing. And the mother dies when she's just 12, I think. And I, you know what? I'm probably not going to get exactly every age and every date right. I apologize for that, but it's a ballpark and you get the idea. Anyway, that was, you know, a terrible time to lose your mother. There's never a good time to lose your mother. But for a young girl, right breaking into your teenage years is a really hard time to lose a mom. And particularly because you're in this big family and most of them are boys, and her one older sister was getting married at the time and that type of thing. So anyway, she became pretty wild. And as I did more research, it keeps in some of the books, it'll just say a friend, you know, she took up with a wild friend or something like that. It turned actually out to be a cousin. So her reputation for not doing good things, and I'm not saying anything promiscuous or anything like that. I'm just saying, you know, who she was. She was a party gal. Let me just say that. She was a party gal. And here she came from this family that was just like this upstanding family, and her father started to get wind of what was going on. He tried as much as he could to persuade her differently, but she would just continue to take up with this group of people. So he sent her to a convent, and it wasn't the convent that she ended up going to. It was another convent. And at first she just hated it. And her friends were always trying to come and sneak in and talk to her and this and that. But then one of the sisters actually took her under her wing. And she fell in love with it. I mean, she knew that was her place. However, when she finished school, she went to a Carmelite convent, and that's where she spent the rest of her life. It wasn't, the convent she was in was not exactly the fit for her. She actually was looking for a more severe lifestyle than they had there. Anyway, that being said, she goes to this new convent. Well, but one of the things I want to make a point of is that for her, she felt she had a choice. She could join the convent or she could get married and have 13 children like her mother. And she always perceived her mother as being exhausted and, you know, not necessarily well, you know, physically. And then she dies young. So she chooses the convent. I mean, that was where she went. So she wasn't even like the day even she took her final vow, she wasn't even sure that she wanted to do this. And there was still part of her that didn't want to do it. But I read that the day that she took her final vows, she received the grace of the vocation. And it was just everything, it just settled for her. That's exactly where she was supposed to be. She had a complicated life in the sense that she was sick a lot. And there were sicknesses that, you know, people didn't know how to treat. I mean, her doctor, her father was a fairly wealthy man. And so even when she was in the convent, he was willing to pay for this doctor or that doctor to look at her. But they never really came up with a, you know, conclusive diagnosis. Although a lot of people say that she suffered from tuberculosis, her symptoms, that type of thing. So anyway, she's in this convent, and it also takes on more of a lax lifestyle where they greet people in the parlor, and she never quite got over that part of her personality that just liked to party and flirt and that type of thing. So there she was in the convent, just doing the same thing she would been doing out in the street, really, and having people in. And she would have some, like, her niece come live with her and, you know, that type of thing. I mean, convents at that time, some of the women who joined them, maybe a large part of the women, were women, they were widows, they were that type of thing. You know, they sought the companionship of the convent, but it wasn't necessarily for the spiritual lifestyle. And she always, what she's known for actually is to be a teacher of prayer. That's what she's called to. And she always tried to learn more about prayer. She was very attracted to it. But again, she always diverted in some way. And it wasn't until she was 40 years old that she was going up some stairs, and she turned the corner and there was a bust of the crucified Jesus, you know, just like this bed, maybe, I don't know, 10 inches or something like that. And she'd walked by it like, a 100 times before, but it caught her eye and she just started staring at the face of Christ crucified. And that just changed everything for her. I mean, it was a long road forward for her, but then it was that at that point she started to get serious about her faith. So she was 40 years old. And so once she became serious about her faith, she actually really wanted to share what she had learned. So she returned to the parlor and started teaching people about prayer. But again, it was just the same thing. She's there, you know, teaching. She's the center of attention, that type of thing. And she realized that she was never going to flourish in that environment. So she talked to some of the sisters that she was with. And some of them were young. And one of them, I think they were talking about, at that time, they were just, I picture them in a room just discussing the church, discussing the scandals in the church and why are we living this lifestyle that's no different from anyone else and that type of thing. And so one of the young sisters said, we need to start a new convent. You know, and they were all in agreement and everything. And then they said, well, who would lead it? You know, who would lead it? Of course, they all looked to her because she's a natural leader. So that is where she met Jesus. I mean, she met him in the truest sense of the word. She did decide to start her own convent. And she had to go through various contacts in that time to get permission. And that was not an easy task, but I'm not going to waste time on that. Anyway, the original convent was actually very upset, of course, that she had taken some of the sisters and she started a more reformed convent, you know, because it looks like she's looking down on them. What I didn't realize when I was reading all this is that the convents are only like a half a block apart. You know, I went to Spain after I, you know, read about her and learned more about her. And I realized how, you know, it's crazy. They're like right down the street from each other, but you would think they were, you know, states away, basically, just because of how the bitterness and everything between them. It wasn't on Teresa's part, but it was on the other sister's part. So anyway, basically, she starts the convent, and her life is a lot about what that was, you know, starting then, what she wanted for her convent. And so, and again, in reaction to what was going on in the world, she wanted her convent to be different. She wanted no more than 13 sisters. She wanted her sisters to be educated. She wanted them to live a life of prayer. She wanted them to, you know, live an austere life, that type of thing. And so, and that is the part of the Carmelites that grew. I mean, the other sisters did not grow like hers did. She founded like 19 foundations before she died. She died at age 65. Her dream was always to travel outside of Spain and, you know, like, you tell the world, that type of thing, be a missionary. And she was a missionary in Spain. And when I went there with on a pilgrimage. And so we went to one of her convents, and that was like 3 or 4 years ago. And the sister told us that this was the first time, like, let's just say this 2018 or 19 or whatever, the first time in all these years. So she was in the 1500s, 1560 or something like that, that they were lacking for vocations. All these years, they had been able to maintain their vocations. And this was, they were coming upon a time where, you know, there weren't enough girls. Before they would have them waiting at the door, and they would go start a new foundation because they couldn't take them in there. So I thought that was really very profound. But anyway, her main thing is, settled down into a teaching people how to pray. And she used this example of the interior castle. So, and that's her famous book, The Interior Castle. And she talks about people who are just entering the castle. You know, they're just on the outside of the castle. They don't really know much spiritually. They're still hanging out. Like, there's still a lot of snakes out there and bugs and all that kind of thing. And that represents the world. You know, so they're still hanging out there. They want to go in, but they have one foot out. And so, and then eventually they go to the second castle in her interior castle, second dwelling, actually. And it talks about the conversion of these people. And then they start really, they're just become, you know, the beginning of just being really, really on fire for their faith. And you and I have met people like that. Well, that's how I was when we started in Tao. I just felt like I rediscovered our Catholic faith all over again, you know, and it's that excitement of you found it. It's the truth. You're here, you know, all of that. And then she said, you know, people will go into the third dwelling. They will advance up to the third dwelling. And I remember reading reading where she said, most people stay at the third dwelling. And the third dwelling has to do with, you know, you have you're a member of a parish, you have your study group, you have your friends are all Catholic, you know, you're kind of like keeping each other accountable, if you will, you know, you're starting to read spiritual books, but again, maybe you're just 1 foot in and 1 foot out, you know, that type of thing. You would rather go out on a Saturday night and talk about the kids, you know, that type of thing. And so from then on, from the third dwelling through the seventh dwelling, it's her way, her teaching on how to get to know God better. And it goes through various stages until the final stage is that you're just absolutely one with God. You want what God wants. And, you know, primarily, I mean, before that, she uses the example of courting. You know, God is courting you. You are in love with him and he is courting you, but you're not quite there yet, you know. And you know, she goes through a period where she introduces the prayer of quiet, where you're just sitting with God. You know, you're just, I think she, I don't remember if this was her, but she employed this, where she said she would go to the Adoration Chapel and she would stare at Jesus and Jesus would stare at her. I don't know if that's the quote from her, but anyway, that's a prayer of quiet where you're just alone with God and that's all you want. I mean, that's really all you want. And you probably feel like with the three kids, the cat and the dog, and the marriage, you know, sometimes you would just really love to go that place, you know, of quiet. And, you know, she tells us we can never really advance without going through these stages. And also, I thought it was interesting because she would say, you go up and down. This is a ladder. You're not always at the seventh dwelling. Sometimes you actually have to start over. You fall or something, and you're like on the first dwelling out with all the reptiles and this and that, the world, you know, and you have to build yourself back up. And that's just a common occurrence. I mean, we say these, you know, the scandals and all that type of thing, but you don't think those men ever started out to be so scandalous. You know, something happens, some temptation, something, you know, I've learned is, you know, disturbed as I am about the scandals in the church, that these are the men that need the most prayer in the church. They need more prayer than anyone, even though it's really hard and you just get disgusted by it. They are the souls that are lost. I mean, Christ must, you know, just weep for them, basically. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. And so I guess that's what I can really tell you about her without getting into really deep. It's just kind of the overview of how her life played out. She was visiting one of her foundations in Alba, Spain. And she had fallen and broken an arm. And so she had another sister with her. They always traveled together. And so she had another sister with her. And she, you know, put her up in the room that they had prepared for her. And then she never got up again. It was just like she had done her job. I mean, she had done her job. And the one thing that she said when she died was, I die a daughter of the church. Which is also just so beautiful. I mean, I think you would love to say you died a son of the church. I would love to say I died a daughter of the church. It meant I fought for the church. I, even with all of the political and within her own religious order, the scandal and the problems they gave her, I mean, it was never an easy path for her. Day one, it was never an easy path. She was always fighting someone. And she fought it. I guess that's the thing that I drew from her, is that she fought it. She knew that God was calling her to this. That was what happened when she saw the bust of Christ, is that she knew that God was calling her to something. It was not like she was passing him by. It was like, uh-oh, you caught me, or whatever. So...
That's fantastic. I gotta say, Terry, I see what Steve likes about you. You guys are fantastic storytellers, both you and he. And I can just sit here and listen to you tell this story for a long, long time. I think listeners will enjoy that as well. I love that story. And of course, set this against the theme of her kind of at odds with the church sometimes, right? As you say. And now think of her here, woman of hope. Right? Here's somebody we can turn to when we might feel like we're kind of stuck in a time when we're at odds with some things happening in the church and confused,
it's
right?
It's so true. I think that sometimes, I think I love my Catholic faith. And we have a wonderful parish priest. So, I mean, he just adds to that love. But I feel like sometimes we're in a parallel journey, like with the Vatican or with Pope Francis. And I mean, we're like parallel playing, if you will. You know, you're all going the same place, but you're definitely not on the same page all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think in my ministry here that I do, I get so many heartbreaking emails from people who say, look, I'm looking into the church. But if I type in Catholic Church on Twitter or on YouTube, I find videos over here saying this and videos over here saying this. And I read the catechism and it says this. And I don't know why no one seems to follow that catechism in the middle there from the church. It seems like nobody's reading that anymore. And I'm like, yeah, Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You know, I try and do my best to point people in the direction of what the church actually teaches and believes and live that out, and our family as well. But I think, like somebody like Saint Teresa, there's somebody we can point to say, hey, look, she struggled too with a church that seemed at times to be at odds with her, but she followed her vocation, she followed that calling, and here's what happened. I think that's a great person, a saint, a doctor, right, to look to in any time, but especially in times when there's confusion in the church and struggle, yeah, and in the church in the world, yeah, I guess, these days, right?
Yeah, there's, you know, that's the thing. There's also such great confusion in the world. Yeah. That's what I long for. If I would say my ideal church is, I would long for peace in the church. You know, where people found comfort. And I mean, it's not that you're not going to struggle, because you're always going to struggle, you know, that type of thing. But not the wars within the church, you know, the battles within the church. I mean, most recently, there's the motu proprio that Pope Francis released on the Latin Mass. I am not a Latin Mass goer, but I feel for the people who are. I mean, they love it. And if someone took away my parish and my church, I would be devastated. You just have to regroup. Do you even want to be part of this anymore? You know, that type of thing. So I would long for something that we weren't getting something new every day, because we get something new every day outside.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
But you know, the people who tell you should say, look to the saints.
Yeah.
Look to the saints. They'll tell the story.
Yeah.
You know, go find your saint, basically, because all of us do have a saint, you know, that we are attracted to in a special way. And we don't always know who it is. You have to study that.
Yeah, I have a fantastic story I've told before on this show of Padre Pio. I have an affinity for Padre Pio and his work. And I was feeling discouraged one day, Terry, about doing this podcast. And I've been working at it for a bit, and it wasn't really going places. And so I sent a little prayer and said, hey, look, Padre Pio, pray for me that the Lord would send me a sign that I should keep going in this ministry, or, you know, or I can quit and do something else. You know, I can go work for the church or something. You know, am I wasting my time here? And I kid you not, within about an hour, I got an email in my inbox from this guy named Nick. And he said, hey, Keith, I love your podcast. I was a cradle Catholic, but I dug into your podcast, and I love it. It's changed my life. Keep going. I love it. Don't stop.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
And he signed the email, okay, as the CEO of the Padre Pio Center of the United States of America.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And I fell out of my chair. And I thought, here's this saint who has, I've asked him for his prayers for me. He sends his CEO.
That's unbelievable. That is so great.
So I know what you mean about these saints we have an affinity for, right? And that for me was this affirmation that here's this saint who's praying for me, by the grace of God, able to do that. Mm-hmm. And these are the best of the church. Right, like we get these, as good as a parish priest might be, or as great as a bishop might be, or a leader in the church somewhere, or my buddy Keith Nestor on YouTube. He's a fantastic guy. He's got great hair. He's got a great ministry. I love him, but he's not a saint yet, right? I mean, he's working on it. I'm sure he will be someday. But the church gives us those saints to say, here, in the midst of all of what's going on, here are the people that you can count on, and knowing that you can emulate their life and live a good Catholic life, right?
And what I actually find most attractive about them is their faults.
Yeah.
I mean, where they fell. I mean, Teresa of Avila really had a bad temper. I mean, she would be scratching, you know, the books would be saying that I read, you know, she's, you know, it's bitter cold in Spain, and it's bitter, bitter cold, and she has no real light but a candle, and her spiritual director is telling her to write the interior castle or whatever, you know, she's scratching out, and, you know, and people are commenting that, you know, hardly makes sense, and, you know, and she's like, this is it, that's what you get, you know, that type of thing. And I don't know, I just love, I mean, she would, you know, in any way you look at her, she is a pistol, you know, she is a piece of work, really. But I love that. And, you know, actually, when I was at Endow, because we worked with a lot of younger women, you know, we liked our we didn't like them. I mean, it attracted women 20 and 30, you know, 20s to 30s. But if I would ever meet with a group of women that age, they would love for me to tell them my mistakes. Like, what were your mistakes when you started this? What were your mistakes when you were, you know, having your conversion, this and that? And I found that so interesting. But I myself love to hear where people failed. And, you know, I mean, not because you're looking at them like, good for you for failing. It's just like, oh, I can relate with you.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway.
Yeah. I have a soft spot too for Carmelites. I swear this happened. People laugh at me, but I was in the 7 p.m. Mass one day, one Sunday evening, and some Carmelite sisters entered, and they have a certain appearance and certain kind of holiness exudes from them as they come in. And I swear I looked over during the Mass and one of them was floating off the ground. I promise you, Terry, it happened. No one believes me, but I swear I saw her off the ground a little bit as we were praying, you know, as the Eucharist was being confected. I thought, okay, I can, that happened, I swear.
You're kidding. That happened to Teresa a lot. I mean, they would have to pull her down.
Yeah, there you go.
Unbelievable.
I did not know that. So look at that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Okay. That's more affirmation. Thank you, Terry. Okay. This is so much fun. Can we do one more?
Sure.
We probably can't do all of them.
I think I'll tell you the story that I most like of Teresa Lisieux.
Okay.
But I want to tell you just a couple of things about St. Catherine and St. Hildegard.
I'm not going to stop you. So.
Okay. Well, St. Catherine also died when she was 33, I think. And I say also, I've been reading St. Faustina today, and she died when she was 33. And, you know, that's the age Christ died when he was 33. So anyway, the thing about St. Catherine of Siena is that she is a young girl when she sees, she has a vision of Christ in the sky. And she right away, she's with her brother. She's walking home from some errand that they ran and for their mother. And anyway, she sees this. And from that point on, she always related the Pope with the sweet Christ Jesus on earth, sweet Christ Jesus. The Pope was the representative, and he is, you know, of the sweet Christ Jesus on earth. And so whenever anyone's ever criticizing a priest or anything like that, could not tolerate it. You know, she could not tolerate it because they were Jesus's representatives, you know, that type of thing. But anyway, a couple of things. I mean, we know her for bringing the Pope back to Rome for a period of time. Actually, she did. And after she died, the papacy went back to Avignon for a while. But that's her kind of claim to fame. She brought the Pope back. But that's not at all what she did in total, you know. But the one thing that stood out about her is, a couple of things. But the one thing that stood out about her is when she died, she felt that she had died a failure. Because the church was in such disarray, and the people were fighting so much, and she had, you know, she did bring the Pope back to Rome, and then he died right away, and so they elected another Pope who was a terror, and so people were just so angry that they at this other Pope that she, you know, that was elected. It wasn't her fault or anything like that, but she was trying to counsel him to be gentle with people and not be so authoritarian and dogmatic and all this other kind of stuff. So she died during his lifetime. I mean, or right at the end of his lifetime. So it was a great sorrow for her. I mean, she was living in Rome at the time that she died. And I had this image that she had the church, like a boat on her shoulders, you know, and she was so frail, so sick, so, broken, I guess is how I would picture her, you know, but she dragged herself to church every day, you know, until, you know, it finally came, it was the end. And she had told all of her followers what she wanted them to do, where she wanted them to go to talk to, that type of thing. And then finally she dies. And again, in her words, I'm a failure. My mission has failed. And then you see, are you kidding me? You didn't fail. I mean, look, I mean, she's right up there with the top saints. Catherine of Siena is right up there. And I think all these saints, one thing they have in common, you were asking me what they had in common, is they spoke truth to power. You know, she, just like Teresa of Avila, she had a lot of trouble with the hierarchy in the church and that type of thing. And she just spoke truth to power, and it worked for her. You know, you really wonder, like today in this whole woke society, if someone would just stand up. You know, but we are all standing up, but who are we, you know? But I mean, someone of great stature would stand up and say, no more. No, no, we're not going to do this. You know, that type of thing. Somebody has to, or we're just going to go along this path of, like, you can't say anything to anyone and you're canceled all the time. And you're, you know, who can live like that? You can't live like that, you know? So anyway, that's the thing about her. And the thing about Hildegard, I mean, Hildegard is just, I mean, she is a character that I've never, ever met before. I mean, I've never read anything. I didn't know anything about her when I, you know, added her to this list. And she is a woman. She lived in 11th, 12th century. She's a woman who could do everything. She absolutely could do everything. Her parents gave her to the church when she started seeing visions when she was 5 years old. She went under the tutelage. Her parents gave her to the church. They had 10 children. She was number 10. That was her tithe, their tithe. She went under this woman's tutelage, and her name was Jutta. And they associated themselves with a Benedictine monastery. And they lived there in this monastery under this most austere conditions. And this woman that she, who, you know, was the only woman that she could relate with was, I mean, she would wear hair shirts all the time and lay on the floor and be beating herself and doing all this kind of stuff. So you would imagine that Hildegard would have taken up that life. But after 20 some years, she dies, and it's like Hildegard breaks loose. And they, you know, her, because of course sisters came, they were attracted to that lifestyle. Anyway, she went on to build three different convents. One of them, and her convents, the convents at that time, they were called monasteries. It wasn't just a place to live. It was a hospital. Teaching. It was a whole community. They grew their own food. They, you know, all that type of thing. And she had that going. And she worked with herbs. She created medicine with herbs. And we still have some of her, like, concoctions or whatever, you know, written down today. She gets misunderstood today because of the New Age movement. You know, they're very much into herbs and all that kind of stuff. So she's kind of been captured by that. And so I think that the reason that Pope Benedict rose, she wasn't even a saint when he named her a doctor of the church, or she was a saint a day or a week or something like that. But I think it was his way of reclaiming her for the Catholic Church, because she was another one. She died in the, you know, in the arms of the church. She, at the very end, she had buried a man in their cemetery, and he had been in a state of sin. And so he was not really allowed to be buried there. But she knew, and he had confessed to her that he had confessed it. And so she allowed him to be buried. And the bishop of that time stopped all the music in her monastery, punished her terribly. And he took away her music, and she's a musician, her music is alive still today. And so, again, she was just punished with such harshness. But she died. They dug up the body. Well, I guess they found out that he did confess or whatever. So was blessed in the end. But great suffering in between. I mean, one thing we know about the church, I mean, it can cause scandal, but it also can cause a lot of pain.
Yeah.
I mean, personal pain. You have certainly felt pain in this apostolate. You know, it takes you to the depths. Not are you, you know, scandalized by other people's behavior. You're scandalized by your own and things that are happening to you. You know, and that's part of Jesus' plan for us. But, okay, my last one is St. Thérèse of Lisieux. I never knew about St. Thérèse of Lisieux. My name is Thérèse. I go by Terry, and I wish to goodness that my parents would have just left it at Thérèse, because that's such a beautiful name now. But you can't go to Thérèse when you're 66. Thérèse when you're 66. I'm changing my name now. I just loved her. I felt, you know, everyone loves her. And I always thought that she was a very saccharine person, very sugary, sweet. She was nothing like that. She was a fighter. She also suffered from a loss of a parent, but she was 4 years old and her mother died. And she was born into a family of five girls. She was the youngest. They all joined a convent. Four of them became Carmelites, and one became, I can't remember, a visitation sister. Anyway, you know, the story of her life is how they're all, you know, discovering their own vocations, how they, you know, how they managed to raise Thérèse because the mother died and they were older. They were in school, that type of thing. So the different sisters that took responsibility for her at different times. The father eventually is diagnosed with dementia, and he's one of the uncles takes in the whole family. And so what I'm trying to paint a picture of is it's a family of great suffering. I mean, they, you know, the, you know, having to go with a relative to take care of the family because the father, who was a watchmaker by trade, had given everything up to work with the mother, who was a lace maker. And they actually had, a thriving business. So, but when that went away, it pretty much went away. And he was more of a mystic. I mean, he was more of a, he wasn't a social guy himself. You know, he was more into himself, but loved his daughters tremendously. So each one of them is coming to him and saying, she's going to join the convent, you know? And so it's for him, he's losing his wife, and then he lost his daughter and another daughter and another daughter. And so by the time Thérèse comes along and she's saying, I want to join the Carmelites. And she wasn't even 15. And, you know, he, you know, it saddened him terribly, but he went to bat for her, took her to Rome. She went to the Pope. She says, I want to join the Carmelites. She's told not to speak to the Pope. They're in a pilgrimage line. She's given strict instructions. Do not say anything. Nobody should say anything. It's Pope Leo the 13th. And she grabs onto him, his hand, and it's like, you know, Holy Father, I really want to join the Carmelite. I want to join the Carmelite. And he's like kind of brushing her off a little bit, like, look at all the line, you know, you're not the only person. And so anyway, he doesn't say yes then, but one thing leads to another, and she's able to join the convent. But you think that would be the end of her problems. It was actually the beginning of her problems. The sisters were jealous of her. They, three of her other sisters were sisters. I mean, were their blood sisters there. So that they were hard on her for that. They, you know, they, she was accused of joining the convent so she could be with her sisters. She endured so much suffering. And there's a story of this one sister who said after she died, she must have loved me so much because she always was so nice to me, you know, that type of thing. Well, in fact, the nun was driving Thérèse crazy but she overcame it and loved this woman beyond measure. And actually that sister left after Therese died. She had to leave. Because there was nothing like it. She got on everyone's nerves. She was a problem, you know, when Therese entered. The interesting thing about that is that when she died, I read this book by Father Frederick. I don't remember his last name. Anyway, he says that when she died, there were 330 people at her funeral. And she had written the story of the soul, story of her soul, and she had told the superior at the time, the devil is going to try to defeat this work. You have to spread it as far and wide as you can after I die, because that's my only chance of telling, you know, the story of my soul and the story of what God wants for all of us and the story of how God worked in her and all this type of thing. So after she died, that's exactly what the superior did. She made copies, sent them to all the Carmelite monasteries, everything, tried to get it out into the public. I mean, within years, it was the bestseller for all over the world. And it still is. And I can see why. I'd never read it. And when I read it, I was wanting the pages to get closer to me. You know, it was like, I just want the pages to be on my chest here so that I can just be with her. You want to be with her. There's something about her. Anyway, after the book was released and all that type of thing, they wanted to bury her somewhere else because so many people were coming to where she was buried. They need to have another place for her. And thousands of people came to that. In just a period of years, it had gone to 30 people not even knowing who she is, all over the world. And then, you know, thousands of people showed up for her, you know, removal and reburial, that type of thing. Anyway, I love those nuns. I love them all.
And remarkable, too, for her, how young she died, too, right? And is considered a doctor of the church.
Yeah, she died at 24.
Yeah,
she died at 24. Hildegard lived a long life. She really lived a long life. She did so much in her life that you could look at Hildegard and say, I love Hildegard because I love her music. And another person could say, I don't even know anything about her music, but I am really attracted to her singing, or her spirituality, or I'm attracted to the way she was such an herbalist and such a natural healer, that type of thing. And not know, you know, this even talking about the same person.
Yeah,
it's incredible. But yes, Therese died of tuberculosis at age 24. And I think there was something that she said on her deathbed. I don't remember what it is, but it's equally profound as, you know, all the others.
Well, these are fabulous stories. And you're a great storyteller. And obviously these stories are told even further detail in the book you've written, Women of Hope. I wonder, tell us a bit about the title, Women of Hope. I mean, we've touched a bit on this already, this idea that these saints stand in contrast or as bright lights in a time when there isn't a lot of hope. And that could be any age, really, in the history of humanity, I think, really.
Right.
Why Women of Hope?
Well, actually, that is interesting. I was feeling so hopeless that summer, so down. One of the reasons I was feeling so down is because I had run this apostolate trying to teach the faith, just like you are, trying to teach the faith. And all these women, there were thousands of women in the apostolate. And now comes 2018, and the church just blows up. I mean, and it's blown up all through the, you know, since 2000, basically, and before. But it just, you know, and so I felt the responsibility for all those women that had been in my program and that had come to love God so much through the teachings of the church, which we had presented to them. And we treated I mean, to me, he's still my favorite saint in a way. I mean, it's Pope John Paul II. I mean, we loved him. You know, we loved his teachings. And not that, but now he's under, people are looking at him. Did he handle this sex abuse thing? Did he not, you know, that kind of thing. And that just breaks my heart. We never presented a bad word about him, you know? So the women just fell in love, with him. He's an easy person to fall in love with how he presented the message, with his teachings, with his writings, all of that. So for me, that kind of came crashing down in 2018 until I remembered it wasn't about me. You know, it was like, well, Terry, it's actually not about you. So anyway, it was just a discouraging time. I mean, so anyway, I was looking for hope. Yeah. That was the point. I was just, give me hope. You know, we need hope here. You know, we can't get up every morning and read about some sex scandal or some priest who's, stolen money from the church or whatever they're doing. You know, that can't be our existence. We need hope. And so that was how it came to be.
That sounds fantastic. We just need to wake up and hear from you every morning to deliver us a new fantastic saint. Tell us all
about
it.
That's so funny.
That'd be fantastic. Terry, this has been really, really fun for me. Hopefully you've enjoyed it as well. I want you to tell listeners and viewers where they can go to get this book and maybe to read more of what you've done or to follow you if you're out there these days. Somewhere, where can they go?
Well, the book was published by Our Sunday Visitor, who I cannot ever say enough nice things about. They are the most wonderful people in the world. They are so patient with me. But anyway, so I would encourage people to go to Our Sunday Visitor bookstore, and you can buy it there. But you can also buy it on Amazon. And, you know, I would say a lot of people buy it on Amazon. It's just what you're familiar with and that type of thing. So I've also written a book. It's called Life and Love. And it's what I wrote it it was on the 20th or 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae. And what I did is I took, I was leading up to Humanae Vitae, and I took 8 different popes who had issued documents about the church's teachings on love and marriage. So I began with Leo the 13th, and then I went to Pope Pius the 11th. And then I can't remember who else after that. But anyway, there were 8 different popes. And the beautiful thing is that actually then it was Paul the 6th and that type of the beautiful thing is how that each one of those popes presented the teachings of the church on this subject. They presented different, but the same. And so I was trying to say basically is that this is not a new teaching. We're not rebelling against something new. It's always been there. It's always been there because it's for your good. You know, I really noticed that I love Pope Leo the 13th. I never had read anything about him. And, you know, he was the one with Teresa of Lisieux, but he was the one who first issued a document on the teachings of the church on love and marriage. And I mean, that's a whole different story that, you know, why he did that and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's my other thing. I mean, that's what I've done. I really am hoping to do another book, and I need to talk to Our Sunday Visitor to see about it. But anyway, I might write a book on Leonie, who is Teresa Lisieux's sister. And she's the visitation sister. And she had tried the convent like 3 times before she was able to stay at this convent. She had a very difficult, complicated life. And she's kind of portrayed as the outlier in the family. But actually, she's up for beatification. I mean, interestingly, someone's bringing her cause forward. And so anyway, I'm interested. I'm interested in people's stories. So
that's fantastic. And we're interested in hearing your telling of their stories because you're a great storyteller. Terry, thank you for being here. It's been really a pleasure. I'm glad, again, that Steve connected us. Thank you to Steve Weidenkopf for that introduction. And thank you. Thanks for being here. I want to say God bless you and the work you're doing for the church and your writing and your ministry and the work you have done in the church for many, many years with Endow and those kinds of things. Thank you. And thanks for being here on the show today.
Thank you, too. I enjoyed it. I really loved it. I get so nervous before these things, but I absolutely loved it.
You did a great job. So, thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, I hope you agree that was a fun conversation. I loved it. What a great storyteller, great stories to tell. My thanks to Terry for being on our show. And again, thanks to Steve Weidenkopf for connecting us as well. What a great conversation and what a great new friendship I think is in the works here. So that's just fantastic. I'll put links to her books in our show notes that you can find in your podcatching app or at thecordialcatholic.com where you can find show notes and blogs I've written and all those kinds of wonderful things. Our weekly newsletter is at newsletter.thecordialcatholic.com to keep informed of what's happening on this show each and every week. I don't sell your email address. Don't send you spam, and I promise to keep those emails informative and interesting. We're on YouTube at youtube.com/thecordialcatholic to watch what you're hearing here. And we're on Instagram and Twitter at Cordial Catholic and on Facebook at The Cordial Catholic. I'm available via email at cordialcatholic@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys. Please do write me, tell you where you're listening from, who you are, and why you listen. I love hearing from you guys and answering your questions and getting in touch with you guys. It's one of the great joys of this ministry to be in touch with you. So thank you for your emails. I get back to those as soon as I can. That's cordialcatholic@gmail.com. Please do follow us on your podcatching app. Leave a rating or review if you can too. Those help to push the podcast out to new people. And please do support this show if you can at patreon.com/cordialcatholic or paypal.me/cordialcatholic. Thank you guys again, guys, for listening. Please know that I am praying for you. Please pray for me too. Talk to you again next week. Thank you, guys. And God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcafe. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.